I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file sharing and personal data storage company that allows users to access their content from any of their devices. Drew co-founded Dropbox with his MIT classmate, Arash Ferdowsi, in 2007. Prior to starting Dropbox, Drew ran another startup, an online SAT prep company called Accolade. He incidentally scored 1600 on his SAT. Drew is from Acton, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you.
There has been a great evolution in storage, from storing files of paper on a shelf to burning CDs to using memory sticks to now storing things in the cloud. How does Dropbox fit into all this?
Yeah, we think about the things you put in Dropbox are the things that kind of were things you would store in your house, right? So you'd open your front door, you put your mail down on the table, photos on the coffee table in the living room, work documents in your briefcase, a filing cabinet somewhere with your financial and health information. All that stuff lives on servers. All that stuff now lives on services like Dropbox. And so we all need our kind of digital home in the cloud. And we think of what we're building as kind of this magical home for all your most important information.
From the photos on your coffee table to, you know, your photos in the cloud, there's been a lot in between.
Right. Yeah, it's just a mess. When anytime some new technology comes along, the old stuff doesn't go away. You're taking all these pictures on your phone, but all your old computers, there's still photos stuck in all those places, and you still have the shoebox under your bed and the, you know, the photos on your fridge. And it's kind of up to you to kind of duct tape all this stuff together.
We talk about storage in the cloud, but there are servers that are actually helping to maintain this. Where do your servers live?
So there's a lot of them. They live on both the West and East Coast. You know, in case anything happens in any place, your stuff will always be safe. Since the beginning, we manage and buy and operate a bunch of our own servers, and then we've also used the public cloud, which refers to places like Amazon. They have Amazon Web Services, and they buy a bunch of servers and manage them and rent them out to companies like ours. And that made it really easy for us to get started because, you know, back then we couldn't afford to spend tens of millions of dollars on equipment, and we could just get started with a credit card.
When did you first think of the idea for Dropbox?
Well, it was out of personal frustration, and one day I forgot my thumb drive. I was taking a trip from Boston to New York. I justified this in my head because I was going to spend the weekend there by thinking of, oh, if I take the bus, I can have, you know, 4.5 hours in each direction, and so 9 hours to get all these things done. And so rush to the bus, get on there, have a seat, open up my laptop, and I paused and had that feeling in the pit of my stomach. I just knew that I had left my little thumb drive with all my company stuff on it back at home. And these were the days before the iPhone and kind of thing where if you didn't have anything to do, you really didn't have anything to do. So I had 4.5 hours to think about how disorganized I am, and I'm like, I never want to have this problem again.
Now, there's a lot of, like, myth-founding stories. Is that actually what happened, or had you been kind of marinating on versions of this even before that momentous epiphany?
Well, I had, at the time, there were all kinds of other services that claimed to do this on paper. At MIT, I had hacked together a bunch of little tools to try to help me manage this. But it was really that bus ride where the first lines of code, I started typing in the first lines of code.
Now, you applied to Y Combinator, which is a seed accelerator or an incubator that in exchange for equity, they give you now roughly, I think, $120,000 to help you get your business started.
They were a little leaner than
They were. It was more like
$15,000. Like
$15,000,
yeah.
Right. Paul Graham said to you, well, you need to find a co-founder if we're going to accept you.
Right.
Now, you had had a co-founder prior. He was a Stanford grad, but he couldn't join you because he had a friend who was starting like a competing technology. So you went to Arash, who had gone to MIT, but you didn't know him at MIT. How did that happen?
It's kind of a long story. A little bit of co-founder musical chairs. So it turned out, as you said, I had a bunch of people who would have been great, but just timing wasn't right. And I was just complaining to anyone who had listened that I'd need a co-founder. And what happened was a friend of mine who I'd also met at MIT named Kyle he knew Arash, and he's like, you guys should really talk. And so we got together in the student center. I think there was a coffee house on the second floor. And now in retrospect, it's kind of crazy because we spent maybe a total of a couple hours together before completely jumping in.
And he dropped out of MIT.
Yeah, it was wild.
So you and Arash completed Y Combinator, and that led you accidentally to another person named Pejman Nozad.
Yeah, Pejman Nozad.
And he was talking Farsi to Arash, because they both happened to be Iranian, and he was taken with your technology. And he was kind of a pivotal person for you very early on, because he introduced you to Sequoia, to your first venture capital.
Yeah, it was wild. Pejman came running up to Arash after our demo at Y Combinator, but we hadn't really heard of him, but he was very persistent and convinced us to come down, and we'd type in the address, and we'd go down to Palo Alto on University Ave, and we get out of the car, and we're like, oh man, we're already running late. This is the wrong place. This is some like rug gallery. But we go inside, and we're like, hey, we probably have the wrong place, but it's Pejman here. The receptionist's like, oh sure, come back here, and you know, you look around, it's just rugs. But we go through this like secret back doorway into this boardroom, and we sit down, they serve us Persian tea, we walk mm-hmm. him through a demo, and next thing we know, he's introducing us to Sequoia. He came with us to the first pitch.
It was his family's rug company that he was operating from, and he actually said to Sequoia, oh yes, you know, they're talking to other venture capitalists who want to invest to just
move things along.
And Michael Moritz from Sequoia shows up at your apartment one Saturday morning to say, here is your $1.2 million. Is that accurate?
More or less, yeah. We go to Sequoia on a Friday, and I get a phone call that night saying, hey, you know, we really like you guys. Next step is usually to have a partners meeting on Monday, but Mike isn't going to be there. Can he come visit on Saturday morning? And I'm thinking, Mike. And I was mm-hmm. like, oh, God, yeah, Mike Moritz, mm-hmm. who's like the godfather of Sequoia. And yeah, next thing you know, he's in our living room. Our mm-hmm. boxes literally aren't even unpacked. Mm-hmm. And we're walking him through a tour of Dropbox.
I want to go back to your Y Combinator application for a moment, because we're talking about raising capital, and they ask you about that on the application. You know, if somebody's interested in buying your company, you know, what would you do? And you'd said, I rather see the idea through, but I'd probably have a hard time turning down $1 million after taxes for 6 months of work.
Right.
But then Steve Jobs offers you 9 digits in 2009. How did you come into contact with Steve originally?
Dropbox was kind of on their radar.
Because you had hacked their system.
The team at Apple had gotten in touch because we did some kind of crazy technical acrobatics with the operating system. And so we did this kind of open heart surgery on this thing called the Finder, which is what shows you your files, which is a technically very difficult thing to do. And so they were confused. They're like, how did you guys do that? And we were thinking, why are you asking us? Like, aren't the people who do that like 100 feet away from you? Mm-hmm. That was what started things. And then they wanted to have conversations about maybe buying the company and eventually kind of move up the food chain to Steve.
What surprised you about the encounter?
Our meeting with Steve was really cordial. And the encounters usually fell into two buckets. You either got chill Steve or very angry Steve. Fortunately, it was the former. He's just like, look, you should join us. And we said, look, we're huge admirers of everything you've done, but we're really having a great time building this company. I'm sure you understand. That's when I thought he'd get upset. But he started taunting us a little bit and saying all these reasons why it wouldn't work, or, you know, it was unlikely to work, and how they were going to have to compete with us and kill us and these kinds of things. But what was fun about it was that it was all kind of done in 15 minutes, and he spent the next 45 minutes just talking to us about entrepreneurship and his path. And you know, I was asking him all these questions about why'd he come back to Apple, and he didn't have to do that.
And P.S., he comes out with iCloud, which is a competitor to Dropbox, but you knew it was coming because he told you he was coming out with a cloud-based solution similar to yours. And even at the time, you know, your customer base wasn't obviously what it is today. You have over 300 million users.
Right.
But at the time, it was more like 2 million?
It's probably about 2 million.
And you acquired those customers in kind of quirky ways. One was with referrals, that if a user referred a friend, that they got more storage for free.
Yeah.
And that was kind of taking a page out of PayPal's playbook, right?
Right. If I tell you about Dropbox, you get some free space, I get some free space. We found that, of all the things we tried, that was really effective. And people would try to collect space, kind of like points, even if they didn't use it. That quickly became the primary way that people found out about Dropbox.
You also made a video in the middle of the night demonstrating the service. Very simple. That really resonated mostly with the tech community.
Right. So it was this quick video just narrating the experience of Dropbox. But what we did was we put all these little Easter eggs in the video that people who frequently went to sites like Reddit or Dig, things that community would understand. And so I learned that from a book called Guerrilla Marketing, which is how do you reach people when you have no money? And it just took off. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people visited in the first day. 75,000 people signed up to try Dropbox. It was literally overnight that we built our critical mass.
By the way, you said you read it in a book called Guerrilla Marketing, which I'm guessing you read on the roof of your fraternity at MIT, where you got your default MBA.
Yes.
And which I'll get to later. But I want to talk about that video, because as I was watching the video, I saw some like very funny names for files laying around. Like, you had one file called People Have No Idea Why They're Doing What They're Doing. Did you make up these file names?
Yeah. Even if you weren't interested in Dropbox, something like something in there might catch your attention. So there were always funny file names. There's XKCD comics. There's a picture of Tom Cruise jumping on a couch. There's references to Obama. He was campaigning back then. We found that it worked.
So where do you get your sense of humor from?
I guess that's a good question. I think, you know, my mom has a great sense of humor. Both of my parents are pretty light-hearted and funny.
I have to admit, I kind of fell into using your service because when I was downloading photos from my iPhone one day, Dropbox kind of appeared and I almost had to use it. Now I'm locked into you forever because even though I had your service for free initially, I now have to pay you monthly?
Mm-hmm. Monthly, yearly.
So you are a Trojan horse in a way. You know, on the one hand, I'm grateful because I know, okay, my photos are safe in addition to the other places I store it. But on the other hand, I'm like, I'm going to have to pay this service for this service ongoing. And that's obviously your hope.
Right.
How do you navigate that? What percent of the people who use Dropbox pay for the service?
Most of the users are free users. But obviously that's how we make the model work is that if you need more space, you can subscribe. But we have to earn that. And so we're always doing more to make the experience better. And hopefully when you look at your credit card statement, it's one of the things that makes you happy and not sad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox. We'll hear more from Drew coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. Drew graduated from MIT in 2006, and before starting Dropbox, he founded an online SAT prep company called Accolade and created a poker bot, which helps you win at online poker. Who knew?
That's right.
Are you a poker player?
I am. Not a great poker player.
Was this like a for-profit endeavor or just something that you were kind of having fun reverse engineering software on a computer one day?
It was a little of both. So I love poker, but what was appealing is since I was little, I've always loved taking things apart. You know, whether it's online poker or all kinds of things, I was able to figure out sort of from the inner workings of how the poker app worked, and I was able to create something where the mouse would move itself and click and figure out what's going on with the game and the artificial intelligence to play. But then, unfortunately, in 2006, poker became illegal or more illegal. And so, you know, I thought to really scale this out would be a lot of different felonies you'd have to commit. Mm-hmm. So I decided to put my attention elsewhere.
There's an image or a story I've heard about you going up to New Hampshire to visit your family in their cottage. You have a car full of your computers and wires to work on this poker bot. Can you tell me about just what that looked like?
Yeah, so we have a little place in New Hampshire on a lake, and you know, most normal people like go swimming and canoeing around and things like that. And you know, I drive by and you know, my mom's like saying, like says hello, and I'm dragging three monitors out of my trunk and setting them up on, it's like I put them on the stove. And I was hooking everything up, and my mom was like, what are you doing? But she knew. This is one of many kind of schemes and projects I've had.
What was your mother's view of that sort of ingenuity?
She's always found it just funny and, you know, just entertaining to watch me and my siblings. My parents, I'm really lucky, and they've always been supportive of everything I've done. They find all of this just pretty funny.
What do your parents do?
So my mom, she just retired. She was a high school librarian at my high school. And my dad is a staff engineer at Draper Lab in Cambridge.
I heard that you've been coding since you were 5 years old.
That's right.
What does that mean? How does a five-year-old code?
So I was lucky. And when I was in diapers and sort of running into the living room, my dad had bought a PC Junior. And so I would, even before I could really read or do anything, I was kind of mashing the keys, and eventually got to the point where my dad was able to show me how to play games and write my first lines of code.
Did you get outdoors a lot, though, as well?
Yes. My siblings and I were limited in our computer time, so we'd have to take turns and be normal for the rest of the time.
We alluded to this at the beginning, but your mom was a librarian, and did it kind of resonate with you that what you're doing is kind of a later form of library work?
We think about that a lot. We store a ton of information in Dropbox, as you can imagine, with hundreds of millions of people using the service. And every day, people store probably dozens of libraries of Congress. Mm-hmm. This is every day.
I want to talk about a speech that you gave at MIT. You talk about the circle of five, which basically is the five people in your life you spent most time with. Can you describe that briefly?
So I think there was a quote I read somewhere that you're the average of the five people you spend time with the most. It's an interesting observation for me because it prompted me to do a lot of different things. It prompted me to move out to San Francisco because that's kind of what Hollywood is to the entertainment industry. Silicon Valley and San Francisco are to internet companies. And when I think of what some of the most important, sort of in retrospect, what some of the most important things I've done, it's really been going to places like MIT, surrounding myself with people that push me in sort of friendly competition.
And one of those people for you was Adam Smith, who was a classmate of yours from MIT. And you say that you would code in your boxers at your fraternity because the air conditioning didn't work. And all of a sudden, you know, he's getting serious and he's getting venture capital and he's getting flown around in helicopters. And that was just the kick in the butt that you needed. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So Adam started a company but almost exactly a year before me, and we would spend the summer coding together, and he was working on his company and I was working on my first company. But very quickly after that summer, he moved out to California, and next thing I knew, I get this phone call from him saying, hey, this investor Vinod Khosla is going to give me $5 million.
And Vinod Khosla, for those who don't know,
is the founder, one of the co-founders of Sun Microsystems. He's this really legendary character in the Valley, and he has a big venture capital firm. And so I was just shocked. I mean, I was super happy for him, but at the same time, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm not getting Publishers Clearinghouse size checks.
And this is the friendly competition you're talking
yeah.
about. In addition to talking about, you know, the circle of five, you talk about the tennis ball. What is that?
When I was working on my first company, after a while, I sort of lost steam. And I thought something's wrong with me, or like, why can't I work hard? But then actually the PokerBot was the project that reminded me that I was obsessed with that thing. And when I think of that kind of obsession, I thought of our dog growing up, Whimsy. When you would throw a tennis ball, she would just go bounding after it, like bashing through stuff, just kind of just tongue hanging out, just looking a little bit crazy. And when I think about people who have done really amazing things, it's really kind of that obsession, and that's what I recognized when I started working on Dropbox. Is this is a problem I can be really excited about for a long time.
Even though you're young, you're also mindful of kind of your numbered days. And, you know, you read somewhere that you have basically 30,000 days to live.
I remember this one night right after moving to San Francisco reading that, yeah, that you live for 30,000 days. And, you know, at first I'm like, okay, this is like a clinically obvious fact. But on a whim, I just opened up the calculator and I typed it in, and I'm like, oh my God, Like, I was 24 at the time or something, and like, I'm like 9,000 days down, almost a third of the way through life. That was just kind of a shock to me that, you know, every day we kind of get a ticket until you don't. And so it really caused me to think about how do you make every day count?
So what's an example of how that influences what you're doing?
For a lot of life, you spend your time like checking boxes and like getting ready to do things. And when I look at a lot of my friends, a lot of them may have wanted to start a company at some point, but they kind of get trapped. They basically spend all these years getting ready to start a company, and then before they know it, they've got kids and a mortgage, and they just don't have the flexibility they had. Instead of trying to get ready, I was just like, all right, I'm just going to do this.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. You mentioned in your application to Y Combinator that you were in a crowded, hostile, competitive environment and that there were lots of companies trying to do what you were doing. And I actually appreciated your candor in the application. You know, you're saying, yeah, you know what? There's not a lot of barriers to entry, but what makes us different is that we're going to execute carefully. What made you think you could do it better or execute better than others? And why were you not daunted by going into such a crowded sector?
What we would say to investors is like, look, if, you know, if any of these things worked, like I wouldn't be here. I'd just use that. Tom Cruise in Minority Report, do you really think he's going to be like carrying a thumb drive around? Right? Or like logging into his Gmail to pick up the thing he had like emailed himself. Mm-hmm. Like obviously your stuff would just follow you around, and mm-hmm. that's not our idea. That idea has been around since my parents were kids. But none of us had that. We had it sort of at school, but then you graduate and it's like back to the Stone Age, and I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I'm my own IT guy. There are a lot of startup ideas that are kind of like that, where it's a terrible idea. Like mobile was like that for a long time. It's just this graveyard until one day, you know, the iPhone comes along and it just works. Or music startups, you know, just didn't work. Then you have Spotify and Pandora. And so I think if the problem is still unsolved, it doesn't really matter how many competitors there are.
Because, though, of the competitive space, the costs are so low, and you talk about file sharing just being chapter one of what you're doing.
Sure.
You're constantly having to innovate, where you're going beyond just being that file sharing service.
Well, our space is evolving, and it's like any other technology. So, I mean, think about your first cell phone. In the beginning, you're like, oh, my God, I can be in my car, and I can be talking. This is like magic. And you're like, okay, how many minutes do I have for my phone calls? Now cell phones do much more than just phone calls. Dropbox is kind of like that, where it's like, oh, I can have my stuff with me wherever I am. I can access it from anywhere. How much space do I have? Now everybody knows that the storage is just an ingredient, and mm-hmm. it's a means to an end. But what people are really doing is they want to have everything in one place. They want to share. They want to collaborate. They want to get work done. And so those are the real problems we're solving. And things like sync or storage, we don't even really use those words that much because what we're really trying to do is solve the underlying problems.
You originally did not have the URL dropbox.com. It was getdropbox.com. And you even started with Evenflow as the name of the company. Can you tell me the story about how you acquired the domain name?
Yeah, getting the domain name was kind of a crazy...
Because somebody else owned
it. Yeah, so we didn't have dropbox.com in the beginning. We had getdropbox.com, so kind of a budget domain name.
How much did you pay for Dropbox ultimately?
We have to keep that secret, unfortunately. But what happened was there's this guy who lived in Pleasanton, which is near San Francisco, and for the first couple of years I was running the company, I would call him and be like, hey, you know, we have an idea for this thing that we want to build. We see that you have Dropbox.com. Can we work something out? And he would say no every time. He's like, and we're like, why? And he's like, oh, I have a project. And it was clear after call 3, 4, 5, 10 that there was no project. And eventually we got so frustrated that we go downstairs, go to the convenience store, like buy the most expensive bottle of $40 champagne we could find, and get in a zip car and drive to his house and ring the doorbell. And he's a little shocked, but the crazy thing, he was an entrepreneur too. And so he sat us down. We tell him a little bit more about what we're doing. And he's like, this is interesting. Let me think about it. And we're like, this is really exciting. Awesome. We'll give you stock. We got great investors, all these things. I'm trying to get him interested. And he's like, I'll talk to you in a couple of days. We're like, we'll be back on Monday. Mm-hmm. And so we come back. We're like, you know, what do you think? He's like, no, I'm just going to hang on to it. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, you know, like bequeath it to your children? Like, what is the end game here? And he was just totally unreasonable. And what happened was he ended up putting all these ads on it that would confuse our users. So we actually ended up sort of, you know, rattling our swords and filing a lawsuit for trademark infringement because it was actually causing confusion. Our users were going to clicking on these ads, and he was making all this money off of confusing people. And so you can't do that. So eventually we got back in touch with him. We're like, look, you know, neither of us wants to be in sort of embroiled in something like this. And finally we were able to, he was able to sell it to us. And he probably should have taken stock. He sold it for cash, probably worth $100 million. Mm-hmm. So just a lot. Right. Paid him a lot less.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. In addition to like customer acquisition and getting venture capital, what was one or two key pivotal moments in the progression of Dropbox in the early days?
Really getting people to understand how to use the product. And what I mean by that is we could see in the numbers that a lot of people would sign up and not start using it, which is always puzzling. And literally in a given day, you would see a note from someone saying, hey, this is like a godsend. This is the simplest, best thing ever. And the next email would be like, what is wrong with you guys? You MIT nerds. Like, you need a PhD to figure this thing out. It's totally impenetrable, and I hate it. And so what we did was we went on Craigslist and offered like $30 or something if you would come in and try Dropbox, and we just put a camera in there. I had a bunch of music equipment, so we would record people just trying out the product. And we found all of these hidden things that were these stumbling blocks. And it was really simple. We're just like, hey, have a seat. Here's an invitation email to Dropbox. Go from here to sharing a file with this email address. 0 of 5 succeeded. Like, they all, like, failed with prejudice. Like, most of them didn't even figure out how to get the thing installed.
Is that because of a trouble in the coding? Bugs in the coding?
You know, it's just kind of unexpected stuff. You know, after you install Dropbox, really, in a sense, it just puts you into this empty folder. And the only interaction you can have with it is through this little icon in the corner of your screen. And so people didn't notice the icon. They didn't notice that we were putting the folder there. They were totally baffled as to what this thing was. And so after that, we made a list of like 80 things that were confusing that we didn't even realize until, you know, they're all obvious in retrospect. But and then we just kind of grinding through them.
That really helped to enhance the ease of use.
Yeah, it was a pivotal moment for us because I think it's really hard to see through your customer's eyes,
right?
Especially if you know every facet of every line of code and know exactly how the thing works. Right. You know, you're almost like screaming through the screen, like, just click, it's right there. How can you not see it?
What are some examples of anecdotes of people actually having success with this service?
I think it's really amazing to me how much it sort of feels like Dropbox has become part of the fabric of how we do all kinds of things. And, you know, everything from, you know, SNL, you know, watch the 40th anniversary SNL episode, that's produced in Dropbox. Mm-hmm. You know, you turn on music, and pretty much every musician I talk to uses Dropbox. Or National Geographic, like all the, you know, flipping through the beautiful photos they have, that's all in Dropbox.
Now, when you say they're using Dropbox, so they're working collaboratively with other people on the files, on the content.
Right. And so they're moving big files around, they're collaborating.
What are other examples?
Someone emailed in, they're like, hey, we use Dropbox at this hospital, and it got flooded, and all of our patients' records were destroyed. But we had a backup in Dropbox, so it literally like saved people's lives. Mm-hmm. To more mundane or just sort of off the wall stuff. To our first head of marketing was here in New York and visiting her hairdresser, and they're making small talk. She's like, "Oh, where do you work?" And Julia was like, "I'm at Dropbox," and the hairdresser like dropped her stuff, and she's like, "I love Dropbox. It's completely changed my life." And Julie's like, what? You know, the hairdresser, you know, makeup artist, not really the first target market we'd think of. And Julie's like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, I do all this production work for this movie. We have to shoot all the scenes out of order. And I got to run around with a clipboard writing down, like, your hair is here and you're wearing this earring and your bracelet and, you know, your sleeves are up. And it's a huge pain because I can't get anything wrong. But now all I do, I have an iPad. All the pre-production footage is in Dropbox. I just see, and when I want to see what were you wearing in the scene before this, I just look at the scene before it, and it's completely saved, you know, hours and hours and hours of my life. Never would have occurred to us that we're, like, creating, like, hairdresser workflow software.
And where do you store your data?
Oh, my God, it's all in Dropbox.
All?
Yeah, as much as I can.
No iCloud?
So for, like, Find My iPhone, I use iCloud. You know, really, all of us are going to end up using all of these services, and that creates a new problem. Like, I need, like, a cloud to connect my clouds.
You love music. How long have you been playing the guitar?
Since the senior year in high school.
Your band Angry Flannel performs from time to time.
Yes.
Why the name Angry Flannel?
We basically had all gotten together. We didn't know each other that well, and we were bickering over the name. And we had interviewed a lot of bad singers. And I think afterwards, and everybody was all emotional, and I'm like, what are we here? Like Angry Flannel or something? And it stuck. I had a chance to track down Eddie Vedder, who was the lead singer of Pearl Jam. They're investors in Dropbox. So he liked the name. He approved.
And speaking of Pearl Jam, Dropbox was originally called Evenflow, which is a Pearl Jam song.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I've been a big Pearl Jam fan for a long time. And we were worried because Dropbox.com wasn't available. If I wasn't going to put Dropbox, I had to put something in. So I'm a huge Pearl Jam fan, and the first name of the company or incorporation certificate still says Evenflow Inc.
And in addition to Pearl Jam being an investor, you too is an investor.
Yes.
Do you secretly wish you were a rock star?
I think that would be a pretty good path. You know, if I could take a year and like tour or be part of something like that, that would be really fun.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox. Coming up, we'll meet Sam Goldman, co-founder of D-Light. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Sam Goldman, co-founder of D-Light, a company that sells affordable solar lighting and power to consumers in developing countries. Roughly 20% of the world population does not have access to reliable electricity. D-Light is focused on providing cleaner, cheaper, safer lighting and energy in over 60 countries. Sam started D-Light in 2007 with Ned Tozin, whom he met at Stanford Business School. Prior to starting D-Light, Sam served in the Peace Corps in Benin, West Africa. Welcome.
Thank you.
Your first foray into the developing world was not in the Peace Corps after college. You grew up with a family who caused you to live in several places. Your mother, for example, was focused on maternal health, right?
Yes.
And your father on agriculture. What are some memories you have of that?
Well, a lot of them, especially when I was growing up, were some of the amazing vacations we took, actually. So, you know, flying into a drug trafficking strip in the Amazon rainforest. You have to take a boat up the Amazon for 3-4 hours, and it's just surrounded by, you know, animals howling at night. Things like that, which were, you know, pretty unusual and very sticky in the child's mind.
What are some impressions of, you know, what your mother did, for instance, that stuck with you outside these exotic vacations?
Right. Well, I just remember, especially in India, she got a plaque saying, you know, thanking her for making a contribution to the lives of 10 million women and children in India. And it was sort of like, oh my gosh, my mom's doing this really interesting work. And she wasn't trying to make huge technological shifts. She was trying to make sure that women understood that they should breastfeed.
How was the experience of the Peace Corps different from what you expected, since you had tangentially been in this world previously?
That's a good question. There's no substitute for actually doing it and living it yourself. You can you can read about it, you can watch movies about it, you can theoreticize about it. But when you go out and actually do it, and you live there, and you feel the seasons, and you eat the same food everybody else does, and you go and you work in the fields and see how long and how much effort it takes to grow yams and then to turn them into a food, and how unreliable your source of income is when you're dependent on the weather and the crops and food prices globally. All these little things that after a while you start to really understand what is important to people.
And it was in the Peace Corps where you had your first experience with kerosene lamps, where you discovered how ineffective and dangerous they are, and that had a deep impact on you. What was your exposure to kerosene lamps firsthand?
And when you're in the Peace Corps, in many countries, certainly in West Africa, you're issued by the government a kerosene lantern. And so I used that for my 3.5 years of Peace Corps service. Mm. and you don't want to use it. And so, and really the game-changing experience for me was when a friend had bought from Walmart or Kmart or somewhere an LED headlamp, and they left the country, and I got their headlamp. And so I just switched over and started wearing this headlamp at night, and all of a sudden I could see things and I could cook inside, and I wanted to read because it was more pleasant, and I didn't feel sort of lightheaded when I was reading under the lamp. And so, and that's when I started like writing LED companies and saying, hey, here's this unmet market need, can I distribute for you, we got to make this happen. And, and
just with these LED lamps,
just with simple battery powered LED lamps, and saying, well, like, why isn't this, why is there, there's a total market failure, why isn't this happening? And literally not one person responded to an email or a letter.
So when did the idea for a solar lamp arrive?
The thing that really tipped me over the edge, my next-door neighbor, he was a 15-year-old boy at the time, he got in a he had a kerosene fire accident, and he almost died, and he got third-degree burns all over his body. But he survived, and he's fine now. But that got me researching. I found out that like a million people a year die from kerosene fires. Once it starts, it spreads all over the place. It causes a lot of harm. So people are, they're scared of kerosene. They're spending a lot of money on it. It's unhealthy for them. And it's really a terrible source of light. It doesn't, it's not actually very bright. Solar is magical. It's like you put it outside and it just delivers you free power. And this notion that you're not going to be dependent on somebody else to charge, and you don't have to walk or drive to a charging station, and you won't have this constant outlay of cash, it totally changes the game. They've never been had independent power, control over their power independently before.
So you had this grievance with kerosene lamps kind of in your back pocket as you made your way to Stanford Business School. How does a biologist and a Peace Corps enthusiast decide to go to business school?
I wasn't planning to go to business school. I was, when I was in Peace Corps, essentially, I was an anti-capitalist. I was this biologist, environmentalist. I had ridden my bike across Canada kind of doing this climate change route. I was doing all these things. And then when I got to Benin, I realized the only thing that was really, really changing the country and changing it quickly was business. Not none of, but a lot of the NGOs and the public sector activities I was seeing in my distant village of 2,000 people, they just weren't having the same impact. So I decided I wanted to go become a social entrepreneur and applied only to the schools that were really on the vanguard of that. And Stanford was one of them.
So I was told that you used to have a beard, you used to wear a lot of necklaces. What did Sam look like 10 years ago?
Gosh. Well, so I didn't have any money. And I didn't have anybody I had to impress for any reasons. So, you know, I wore a lot of the local garb. So very long, flowy clothes. You know, my best friend in my village was a tailor. You know, it could be a living room. It could be patterns of a living room all over my body, or like, I don't know, like bananas, or like it was really sort of fun. You know, if you've seen West African clothes, they're beautiful and they're gorgeous and they're creative. Yeah, and a big beard and sometimes colored hair, and you know, just I was having fun.
This is your Peace Corps years.
These are my Peace Corps years.
So yeah. Come Stanford Business School. How long did that last?
Well, you know, you drive up that palm-lined boulevard and, you know, every leaf that falls off a tree gets somehow miraculously swept up by someone somewhere. It's hard to be quite so. And you don't realize, you just, you know, we're humans, right? We adapt to our circumstances. So when I was in a village, there's no washing machine anywhere. You do it by hand. Nothing ever gets clean. And so that was just the way I kind of was. But then once I'd shifted focus, yeah, I kind of cleaned up my act.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Sam Goldman, co-founder of D-Light, a company that produces solar lighting and energy products to consumers at the bottom of the pyramid in developing countries, where one out of three people does not have access to reliable energy. The idea and prototypes for D-Light grew out of a class that Sam took at Stanford Business School with co-founder Ned Tozem, called Design for Extreme Affordability. Now, I say it was out of the business school, but it was really out of the Stanford Design School, where pioneer David Kelly, he founded this program. Can you talk to me about how the idea went from just that to something more concrete in that space?
Yeah, absolutely. The Design School was almost a startup within Stanford. The first semester was essentially learning how to do design and human-centered design the way IDEO kind of teaches it. with all sorts of mini projects. And then the second semester was we had a client, a customer, which was an NGO based in Myanmar, and we had to go and actually produce something valuable for them that they could take to market. And they worked in the water space predominantly. And for whatever reason, there was a small group of us who we just weren't as excited about doing something in the water space, and we really wanted to do energy. And I personally was pushing a lot for doing something in energy because I had been in Peace Corps, and I had lived for a couple of years with a kerosene lantern, and I knew that there were better options. And so I knew that was true also in Myanmar. And so we kind of coalesced and talked to this NGO about whether we could go and would they be interested if we could come up with a better source of lighting than what the typical population in Myanmar would have. If we could design something, would they be interested in taking it to market? And they said, yes, that would be a good project. Let's do it.
What did you discover in Myanmar specifically because of the totalitarian government?
I mean, the country used to be a source where people would go to Myanmar for higher education. All over South Asia was recognized. There was actually somewhat of a grid that went out to these villages, and there was electricity, and it's all fallen apart. They didn't even have kerosene, which is sort of the worst form of lighting for most people in the world, but kerosene was banned. So people would burn diesel as their only source of light if they could get it. Or if you didn't want to burn diesel, which is, you can imagine, pretty noxious way to live your life, you would pony up for very expensive tiny little candles that would burn quickly. And then if you had a little more money and wanted to splurge, you could buy these really noxious lead acid batteries, which would run for like a day or two, and they would charge them up on these massive, like, I don't know, 1920, 1930s generators. And they would tell us, like, oh, yeah, you know that the batteries are being charged well if the acid is boiling. The whole thing was so amazingly wrong and backwards that it really... it blew our minds, and I think some of the stories were what allowed us, I think, ultimately to get some of the venture funding we got in the Valley.
What are some of those stories?
You know, we participated in this one thing called the DFJ Venture Challenge.
DFJ being Draper Fisher, a leading venture firm in the Valley.
Venture firm. And what they do is they take all the winners of the various business school competitions and they pit them all up against each other in this one DFJ Venture Challenge. We went in to just sort of tell the human story. And the story we told was about a woman named Mia. And we had gone to her village and left them some very early prototypes, look nothing like what we have now. It was a large family, and they would essentially get up at like 10 p.m., go out, dig up the earth, and work all night making these mud bricks, which they sold for half a penny each later. And they would have to work all night and then get done in the morning and leave them out so that during the day they would get baked by the sun and then they could sell the bricks. And so these lice completely changed their lives. But she literally started crying when we said, you know, we have to take these prototypes back. They're not going to work long term. This is just something we put together. This is like one lady out of 2 billion. And this is going to matter, and it's going to matter a lot.
What did the initial prototypes out of the D School look like?
Yeah, there were. I mean, and obviously the D School methodology is get it done and get it done fast and learn as quickly as you can, right? So, I mean, we just had, you'd slap a battery into a box and run a naked wire off it to a little circuit board with some LED soldered to it. I mean, it was not a consumer product in any way, shape, or form. And we just wanted to experiment with how much power, how much light is enough, what are kind of the price points that we need to hit to make this viable. And then also, does it have to be solar? Can it be a combination of, you know, just fast charging technology or batteries or not?
Distribution was harder for you than you had expected. Can you talk to me about what that landscape is? Because that's really the gating factor in a way.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. We don't realize that the average base of the pyramid family or individual is not a consumer. A lot of them are subsistence farmers. They grow their own food. They buy just a few essentials that they absolutely need. They are used to word of mouth, and they're used to testimonials that come from people they trust, not from companies that come from some other land.
Right.
And that is the hard and expensive part, is to get out and actually build a new category that did not exist even a couple of years ago.
Can you give some examples of just firsthand experience that you had in educating?
Well, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, we were at this award ceremony yesterday, and one of the speakers who came and we're honored to have him was the CEO of SKS Microfinance, which is one of the world's largest microfinance institutes. And we have partnered with them. And we originally started, and I did in 2008 when I went to India, because microfinance loan officers are actually going out into the deepest communities, and, you know, groups of women come once a week and meet together And they distribute loans of $200 or less to these women, but it's an opportunity to say, here's a new technology, and it's coming from somebody they trust, who they know and have known for many weeks, and to say, here it is, here's how it works. If you'd be interested, we'd be able to offer it to you on some kind of financing so that it doesn't become a burden, and they can go and try it and experience it. And that's an example of a distribution channel, which has been very, very powerful for us and a very good partner.
Another partner for you is the French company Total. Who are they?
Absolutely. So that's another, you know, a really interesting one that you wouldn't immediately think about. But, you know, Total has an interest in being an energy company, not just in being an oil company, even though that, you know, I don't know exactly their revenue split. But they have retails, almost like mini marts, gas stations all over the world. And they have a very high concentration of them in Africa and South Asia also. And so we've partnered with them to be able to put our lights into their stations, which is a trusted, well-known place that people can go to if they want to buy the technology.
The price of your technologies range from, is it $7 to $40, depending upon what you're selling? Is that
It really ranges from probably around $8 to $10 on the low end up to, you know, just south of $200 for a solar home system with multiple lights and, you know, running a radio and charging cell phones and doing other things.
Do you remember your first customers?
Yeah, we had first customers. I mean, we had sold things before we moved overseas. We were working out of a garage in Mountain View. I mean, we were kind of the typical startup. And I remember we had sold things before we even had products. So I had sold into, I think it was the Infosys Foundation in India. And when I think about it now, it's ridiculous, right? We hadn't finished making the product. We certainly hadn't shipped it. And when we did try to ship it, this is before, like, we didn't know any of the details of international business. You have to get all these permits. And you can't just bring a product into a country, and we didn't have the VAT certificate, all this stuff. So it was a pretty steep learning curve. I would be really excited to redo another business at some point where I don't have to go through all these learnings and can just get it right the first time.
We're talking a little bit at 10,000 feet on the impact that these lights and these products have had. Can you talk to me on a more granular level on how you've changed these people's lives?
Oh, absolutely. You know, this was in Uttar Pradesh in India, which is one of the largest states. And we were coming back and talking to a farmer at night, and he was saying, oh, and he was using Hindi, and I don't know the exact phrase, but he was essentially saying, thank you. D-Light is almost like a god. It's, you know, thank you so much for having brought this. I was coming back and a snake almost bit me, but I saw the snake because I have your light. And then proceeded to tell us all these stories of other people who'd been bitten by snakes and leading to, you know, often fatal accidents.
I heard that you were bit by a snake at some point and you had a kerosene lamp.
Right? Yeah, I did. I did actually during Peace Corps walk in. I was, because, you know, with a kerosene lamp, you can't really see anything. So I did walk into my house once and got bitten by a snake, dropped the lantern, it smashed. I'm sitting in the dark. I know I've been bitten. And it turned into quite an adventure because my health center didn't have any vaccines, and a friend of mine, like, put me on the back of his motorcycle, drove me 7 kilometers. I get to this health center, and the guy says, oh, great, yeah, I actually have the serum for you, and you're really lucky because somebody came in last week for it, but they couldn't afford it, so I couldn't give it to them.
Huh.
It's like, oh, gosh.
You've spent the majority of your time in the developing world. You're living in Vancouver now in Canada, but you were living in India prior. How long were you in India after business school and getting this off the ground?
After business school, I moved to India. My co-founder moved to Shenzhen, China. And essentially, I started up the sales and marketing. I was running product development. And he was doing more operations and finance part of the company. And so I was in India for a couple of years. But I'd actually done my high school there. So I had some familiarity and knew some people in India. And then I moved to Hong Kong and opened the office there as we started to expand more internationally. And now I live in Vancouver because my wife, I'm half Canadian. My wife's also Canadian. And
speaking of your wife, I was wondering what your kind of private social life was life. You know, because you've had a nomadic existence, and then I saw you walk into the office here with your wife Rosie, who is pregnant. It's nice to see that part of your life was able to be enriched simultaneous with you know, your professional one. How did you meet your wife? How did you meet Rosie?
We met originally, I met Rosie in undergraduate, and we were together, and there was something just magical about the way we were, but school ended, we both went our separate ways and sort of kept in touch with each other maybe once every 5 years or so, but a group of friends from undergraduate, we do kayaking trips every once in a while. Now we've turned it into a habit in British Columbia and Canada, and so we saw each other 1 year, and the next thing I know, she was coming over to Hong Kong on a one-way ticket, and things went from there.
What do your parents make of all this?
Oh, of course, they're ridiculously excited and proud of all the work that we're doing. And it's so much an extension of what they had done beforehand. Just opening up their, you know, they had very good personal relationships with people all over the world, whether it was in India with the business or health communities, or whether it was in Rwanda with the, you know, government communities, and just being able to link me back into those families and individuals. Because in the end, whether it's business or whether it's development work, it's all personal.
So they had a vast Rolodex.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Isn't it interesting how we use the term Rolodex now?
Yeah.
You've spent your life shifting back and forth between developing countries and, you know, Canada or the United States. What do you find most striking when you return to, let's say, Vancouver?
How lucky we are. Yeah, the world's not fair, the work that people have to do for a couple dollars a day.
Even in your daily life, like, what do you find striking?
Well, landing, you know, you land in Vancouver if you're coming from Beijing or you're coming from New Delhi, and it's like you have to squint because it's so bright and the sun, like the sun's just blaring and it's so clean and pure and the air is so, you know, it's a like little thing. The air is so pure. Like, where else do I get this kind of air that I can breathe, which you'd think everybody would get? And it's so silent. The streets are more or less empty. Nobody's bothering me, and I can go home to my house where I can drink the water out of the tap. And it's just all these really kind of banal stuff, which we take totally for granted, but everything works.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sam Goldman, co-founder of Delight. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.